You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about news deserts in Wisconsin, the areas of the state that lack local news coverage, and what's being done to fix it.
First, Governor Scott Walker wants Wisconsin to scrap the state's minimum requirement for how many hours students spend in school. Rather, he'd like to see school districts set their own hours and be judged by their state report cards. Here he is making his case at a Waukesha school last week.
If our students are succeeding, honestly, I don't care how many hours they're in, if they're seeing success. To me, the report card is the ultimate measure. It's not how many hours are you sitting in a chair.
Currently, the state requires elementary schools to provide a minimum of 1,050 hours of instruction, and secondary schools 1,137 hours. If his move is successful, Wisconsin would become the first state to no longer require the schools offer a minimum number of hours or days of instruction.
Erin Richards joins us now. She's an education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello.
So this proposal is part of the governor's new budget plan, which boosts education funding and which he says will help every student in Wisconsin succeed. How does doing away with the minimum hour requirement for schools play into that vision?
I think that's what had a lot of people in education circles scratching their heads about, especially because a couple of years ago, the state budget eliminated the mandate for at least 180 days of instruction in the state. And the argument made for that at the time was that the state already had a mandate for the minimum hours kids should be in class, so give districts some more flexibility on how to complete those hours. And so dropping that as well raised some eyebrows, even with the School Boards Association in the state, which had actually advocated for dropping the 180-day requirement, and School Boards Association tends to be in favor of local districts making their own decisions. But even they thought, you know, if you eliminate this entirely, many districts would continue to operate as normal, but you'd certainly hate to see an independent school or a private school that participates in the voucher program or some other charter school just not teach kids as many hours. You remove the baseline, you could invite an abuse potentially in the future, and that's the concern.
So when there was a requirement for a certain number of days and a certain number of hours, it sounds like there was a call to eliminate one of them, and the days were eliminated. But has anyone actually been calling for this part that deals with the number of hours and to get rid of that?
I saw this in the state budget, and I tracked it down because I wanted to know where this originated from. It seems to have had the most interest from one of the cooperative educational service agencies in the state. Those are the groups that consortiums of groups that work with districts and regions. And this is the agency up around Oshkosh that had several superintendents in the region that were interested in more flexibility for example, delivering instruction in different ways, similar to how charter schools have some freedom from the rules on hours of instruction and days of instruction. The superintendent of the Neenah School District said, look, you know, if our district had these flexibilities, we could go, we could go longer some days or shorter some days. She also said that snow days can be a hurdle when districts only plan for 3 snow days, and then we get a heavy winter and 7 days are needed, and then you tack them on to the end of the year, and then attendance really suffers. So those were the biggest arguments for it. And I think Chippewa Falls had also said, had also looked at the snow day element as a potential there. But for the most part, parents we've heard from and polled at the Journal Sentinel and other residents that have weighed in have thought that removing the baseline just may not be a great idea.
So under the governor's plan, districts and individual schools would be rated according to their state report cards, which are produced annually by the Department of Public Instruction. How are those report cards calculated?
The report cards take into account a variety of different measures, everything from attendance, the percentage of students who participate in the state tests, academic achievement over the course of the year, and then how much students improve over a number of years. So the report cards are actually calculating multiple years of data. In recent years, more people have called for those report cards to be even more comprehensive and include things like how many arts and extracurricular classes or, you know, sort of elective classes are schools offering. That hasn't happened yet. Most of the data in the report card is student demographic data, achievement and growth data, and graduation rate data where that's available. So in many ways, the people that are saying, you know, look, we're okay with dropping the hours because the state report cards are becoming more robust and we can always judge schools on the back end by how well they're doing. And if someone, you know, isn't instructing kids to at least, you know, sort of a minimal expectation that the results would be low for that school, and that would eventually show up on a report card. The problem with that concept is that the report cards have no penalty for anybody who's scoring really low. So if your school gets a very low scoring report card, the only thing that would be the penalty would think that parents may not choose that school anymore if the report card score was quite low. But there's no sort of hammer on the back end of a school that has a low report card score.
And has there been any response from the Department of Public Instruction to this proposal?
You know, they tend to stay a little bit neutral on some of the policy stuff. I don't think they're in favor of it. They certainly haven't advocated for it. Tony Evers, the state superintendent, has said he thinks it should remain. So he personally is against dropping that altogether. And that's the most we know from the department at the moment.
We're talking with Erin Richards. She reports on education at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about Governor Walker's proposal to eliminate the minimum number of hours of instruction that right now have to be given to students in elementary and secondary schools. Erin, how does this plan, this idea of Governor Walker's, fit in with the vision of school reformers at the national level, for instance, with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos?
Nobody nationally is making a big push to drop instructional hour minimums. In fact, what is interesting about this proposal is that if Wisconsin did away with the hours of instruction mandate, it would be the only state in the country that has no expectation for a minimum number of hours or days that kids have to be in school. The other unusual move here is that this changing this law as it's written would also apply to the private schools that receive public money through tuition vouchers. It would apply to charter schools. It would also apply to virtual charter schools and drop the minimum mandate that teachers have to be available to online students. And, you know, we don't know as much about how virtual schools are performing. A lot of their report card scores are lower, but that's also because some of them take, you know, students who may not be doing great in the traditional environment. So if you drop all of those expectations, for some people it can be a little worrisome because, you know, we don't know as much about, you know, virtual charter and voucher schools as we do. We just don't have as much data about them as we have about traditional public schools.
So that we're talking about this in Wisconsin, and as you said, Wisconsin would be the first state to do away completely with either hours or days in the classroom. I'm kind of surprised that this isn't something, at least at a very minimal baseline level, isn't dictated from the Department of Education.
Well, remember that most educational policies like this are set at the state level. Much of education is you know, sort of state controlled or controlled at the district level. So, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon or, you know, out of the norm for hours of instruction to be set by every state, just like every state sets its own graduation requirements for high school, which, you know, may be a little concerning for some folks, but that is a state decision. So what sometimes happens is we see trends in just based on what political parties sometimes want. A couple of years ago, there was a push in many states to require a civics exam for students to pass a civics exam before they could graduate. And that was passed here as well as a number of other states. But on this particular hours of instruction proposal, it doesn't seem to be originating from anywhere else. This seems to be a very a response to what some superintendents in one part of the state wanted, and the question now is whether it would go anywhere. It's been taken out of the governor's proposed budget, at least the budget that the Joint Finance Committee will consider. They've taken out a bunch of the policy proposals, so they're just considering the money question right now. So if this comes up, I think it would have to come up as separate legislation since it's been pulled from the budget.
So President Obama had actually pushed for an increase in instruction time, saying that American children each year spend at least a month less in school than children in places like South Korea, for example. This proposal, it would seem, might have the potential to put students at a greater competitive disadvantage if they're spending potentially even less time in school.
President Obama and his administration were particularly concerned about the length of time that students in poor and more disadvantaged communities were in school. We know from research that many schools that get better outcomes with lower income and other disadvantaged subgroups of students, we know from research that they tend to have better outcomes when they're in school longer and being exposed to more instruction. That's certainly a strategy that many high-achieving charter schools have implemented over the years, and it was a step that the administration was encouraging. I think the impact may be a little bit less in a higher-performing suburban school, but you're right, that was certainly a central goal of the Obama administration, was to look at increasing hours of instruction, but specifically that proposal was most concerned with kids who are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Well, Aaron, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Aaron Richards, education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She gave us details of Governor Walker's plan to remove the requirement that schools offer a minimum number of hours of instruction to students per year. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, there's a new kind of contraceptive on the brink of being approved, an injectable male birth control. We'll find out why it's facing barriers to make it onto the market.
First, a project underway at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is trying to identify so-called news deserts around Wisconsin. These are geographic or demographic gaps where news coverage doesn't exist. And the gaps aren't just isolated to rural areas where a local newspaper may no longer be in circulation.
Mia Sato joins us now. She's heading up this news desert project. She's the public engagement and marketing intern at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism here on the UW-Madison campus. Mia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So explain for us, what are news deserts?
Sure. So a news desert is similar to a food desert, if you've heard that term. So they're either geographic or demographic areas that are starved and parched of local, fresh, relevant news. And so the geographic area is kind of self-explanatory. A newspaper might shut down, or maybe there never was a local paper to cover that area. And then the demographic area is more, or the demographic groups are more, I guess, varied. So it could be that the coverage of these groups isn't very representative. It could be that the only coverage of the groups are certain types of stories, things like that.
So you made the example in Milwaukee, African-American coverage in Milwaukee. Is that one example?
So I've heard conflicting things about that example, actually. Some people say that coverage tends to be limited to a lot of crime stories and the occasional feel-good story. But then I've also heard folks saying that there's a wealth of Black media outlets for those communities. So it's something that I'm planning on looking more into.
As you look into this issue, do you see a problem with news deserts here in Wisconsin?
All the research that I've read has said that it's a problem across the United States. So I brought some statistics to kind of outline it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics said that newspaper employment went down more than 50% from 2001 to 2016. And there's several national projects, such as the Media Deserts Project at Ohio University. There was a report from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill saying what a problem this is across the country. So this is something that we're looking into at Wisconsin and seeing what degree of a problem we have.
And this particular issue is something of interest to you because you grew up, you said your grandparents read different newspapers.
Yeah, I am now realizing that I was really lucky to be growing up in areas where there was a lot of newspapers and a lot of coverage. I come from a biracial, multicultural, multinational family, and I remember my mom's family is from Appleton. One of my earliest memories growing up is seeing my grandma spread the Post Crescent across the living room floor and read every single page front to back. And I remember my dad always having weekly newspapers, weeklies, carrying them around that were published in Japan, obviously. So I have been very lucky, and I'm noticing now that not everyone has shared the same experience as I have.
Mia, where are you with your research at this point?
Right now, I'm just in the process of talking to as many citizens, as many journalists, as many publishers as I possibly can, and trying to identify the areas of interest.
What have you found so far in talking to people?
I've gotten a lot of comments about Northwestern Wisconsin, especially around the Twin Cities, and how they don't get like Wisconsin television channels. They don't know who's running for local office. They don't get Wisconsin political coverage. And actually, just as I was up on my way up to the studio, I got an email saying that a reporter in Madison was mentioning how her hometown paper, the Chilton Journal Times, just shut down. And there's coverage from the Post Crescent of the Chilton area, but it's a really small community of about 3,000 people, so the coverage is limited.
We're talking right now with Mia Sato. She is public engagement and marketing intern at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She has a program underway, or a research project underway, looking at news deserts around Wisconsin. Mia, how concerned should we be about news deserts and whether they exist at all?
I think it's a huge concern for everyone, not just people in small communities or rural areas or marginalized communities, but local news is really the backbone in a lot of cases for political awareness and social engagement. And the local politics that occur at the state and city levels are immensely important to everyone.
Once you've gathered all your research, you've identified the areas that don't have adequate local news coverage or have demographic gaps, then what? What happens?
We hope to work with existing news infrastructure. So it's not that we're saying that there's no outlets in these areas, but we recognize that there's great local journalism that's taking place and people working really, really hard. So part of the mission of the center is to increase the quality and the quantity of investigative reporting and news in general. So really working with the people who are already on the ground, trying to come up with solutions to these problems, because we recognize that the problems will look different in every area.
So what's your toughest challenge in identifying a news desert and figuring out, is there really a lack of local coverage here?
I think something that I'm running into is it's really hard to compare two areas or two demographics or an area and a demographic. And it's really hard to say, like, one place has it worse than another. Just because you get 6 emails from people in one community doesn't necessarily mean that that problem is worse than an area that you only get 1 email about. So I'm just trying to learn as much as I possibly can, hear from as many people, whether those are concerned citizens, community organizers, different organizations, things like that.
And how should the public get involved? How do you want people to get involved with you and talk to you?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I'm hoping that some listeners will be able to chime in. People can email me at msato@wisconsinwatch.org, msato@wisconsinwatch.org. And that's really where I've been communicating with a lot of people, emailing back and forth, calling. And also, if you're an organization, feel free to reach out to me as well.
And then how long is this process? How long will this research gathering process be?
So we kind of foresee this being a multi-year project. So we would take, right now we're working on identifying one geographic and one demographic community. And then next year, perhaps doing another set, because we recognize that there aren't just two news deserts in the state of Wisconsin, and recognize that it will take a while to learn the intricacies of these communities and what their needs are. So we are hoping that this will be a sustaining project.
And when people reach out to you, what would be most helpful for them to tell you? What do you need from them?
I guess, what is it like for you to get news? How do you find out what's going on right around you? Is that Facebook? Is it friends? Word of mouth? Do you have to go online for all of your news because there isn't a paper in your area? I would just love to hear what it is like for you to find out what's going on.
How has Facebook impacted local news coverage?
I'm not sure.
And how are you treating it as part of your research?
Sure. Yeah, we're definitely taking it into account because I have heard comments from folks saying that the only way they can find out what's going on is through Facebook posts that people in their town have posted, things like that. So I don't have any numbers or I don't really know how exactly Facebook has affected it, but I think everyone around, you know, journalists definitely see the impact that it's had, but we're trying right now to put our finger on it.
And how will you share your results, your information with other states and other projects? And what does that add up to?
Sure. We're definitely trying to have it be a replicable model. So we're hoping to have a map that identifies all the different news outlets, where there are holes in it. And once we can brainstorm with community groups, citizens, then we can share those results. We're really about sharing what our findings and our stories for free for everyone. So the center will surely uphold that.
And so basically, ideally, once you would get pool all that research, you could have this interactive map. I could go on there and find out what my local news options are for where I live in my zip code.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That's what we're trying to get.
And as we go out here, what is the next step in this project? What are you working on next?
So right now we're trying to touch base with people maybe at one level above everyday citizens. So we're looking at experts from other states, people who have done national projects, getting best practices, and really trying to gather our data in a way that makes sense, in a way that's correct, and in a way that we can use, and then we can share the results with other groups.
Mia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mia Sato is public engagement and marketing intern for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism here in Madison. She joined us to talk about a project that seeks to identify news deserts around Wisconsin.
Coming up, for the first time in over a century, a new kind of male birth control might become available. But pharmaceutical companies haven't jumped on it yet. We'll find out why. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7 on Reveal, if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed to you. That's how it's supposed to work. But in New Orleans, the public defender's office has such a backlog that it's refusing some serious cases, which is jamming up the courts and leaving hundreds of people stuck in jail with no lawyer. That's on Reveal tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, in rural India, doctors are on the brink of a medical breakthrough. They're preparing to submit a male contraceptive for approval. The drug would be the first new male contraceptive in more than a century. The injection would make sperm infertile, and it can also be reversed.
The inventor said that the procedure would be particularly useful for people reluctant to use condoms. A Bloomberg report said it would also be low cost, making it especially helpful for poor populations and people in developing countries.
The report also says the drug market for female contraceptives worldwide is worth about $10 billion, and male birth control would have the potential to win as much as half of that market. But despite trials finding that it's safe and convenient to use, the new contraceptive still hasn't gotten much interest from drug companies that could sell it.
Julie Beck is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers health and psychology. She's been writing about male and female birth control and joins us now. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Give us an overview of the contraceptive market landscape, if you will. What procedures, what drugs are available?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty much all for women. The only male contraceptive that exists right now, short of a vasectomy, is a condom. And then, obviously, there are a ton of options for female birth control. There is, you know, the pill, but that encompasses a really large diversity of just, like, you know, different kinds of hormones, mixed hormones, progestin only, etc., IUDs, implants, and, you know, then, of course, you get into kind of female condoms and things like that, which are not super popular here in the States, but still exist. And so the burden of birth control is pretty much always been mostly on women.
How would this particular birth control that is coming out in India, how would it work?
Yeah, I've been hearing about this, vasal gel or Resug, as it's called in different places, for years now, and people have been really excited about it for years now, and it seems like it's finally, you know, maybe actually happening. And I guess I kind of think about it almost as like an IUD for men, not an exact analog, but, you know, something that, a procedure that's pretty minimally invasive, you get done once, it's reversible, and then you don't have to think about it, until you want it removed or you want it reversed. Although I'm not super clear on the side effects, I think that the IUD probably has more. But yeah, it's pretty minimal. I think they just inject a gel into the vas deferens, and then as the sperm swim through it, there's sort of a positive charge and a negative charge, and it neutralizes them, basically makes them ineffective. And you can get another injection to clear the gel out and, you know, get a woman pregnant just as you would before, and it seems to be completely reversible.
How effective is it? What do we know about its effect?
You know, I think it's pretty remarkably effective. I think it's pretty remarkably cheap, and, you know, pretty remarkably safe as well.
And a gynecology professor quoted in this article saying, look, Big Pharma is run by middle-aged white men, she said, who would never go for this, and there lies the rub. How does that come into play in how this contraceptive is being approached by Big Pharma?
Yeah, you know, I have so many thoughts about this. You know, I think that the attitude towards male birth control is really out of step with what men actually want. You know, there was a male birth control trial recently that was stopped because of side effects. And the side effects were not markedly different from what women experience on birth control that is approved by the FDA. And the interesting thing about this is that the study was stopped, but the men who were in the study and who were experiencing the side effects wanted to continue using it. So I think men want it. And maybe there is this attitude from the companies or from above or just from society at large that they would never tolerate it, that they wouldn't put up with the side effects, that they wouldn't put up with, you know, even the responsibility of just taking a pill every day or whatever. And I think a lot of men actually do want to have that choice.
How much would it cost for, say, a pharmaceutical company to make this available?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I can't think that it is, you know, much more than the female birth control. And I think it would probably, you know, get them a lot of money in the end because there is a demand for it.
So why is there the problem then of finding a distributor here? You know, where would the demand for male birth control come from if the people who seem to want it are asking for it, and it seems like you just need the middleman?
Yeah, I really think there is just this holdover attitude that this isn't something that men will tolerate. And I don't think that that's true, but I think there is this just sort of social sense that it's the women's responsibility. And, you know, when they were originally researching the pill, at the same time, the company that was doing that was researching a male form of birth control as well. And there were some side effects with that. And the original, you know, women's birth control pill side effects were horrible. But they kind of abandoned the male one, saying that they believed that women would tolerate the side effects better than men because, you know, men wanted a better quality of life. And the problem is, you know, they're kind of right, because women put up with these side effects, and they put up with all manner of things because it's on their bodies. You know, the responsibility falls on their bodies ultimately, in a way that it doesn't for men.
We're talking right now with Julie Beck. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers health and psychology. We're talking about a new male contraceptive breakthrough that has been discovered in rural India, and it is preparing to submit a male contraceptive for approval. Julie, let's look at the world view here. How might this benefit people in other parts of the world, particularly in developing nations?
Yeah, I mean, I think the price point is a really big selling point. If it's cheap and it's easy, that makes it much more accessible to people who might not be able to afford other kinds of birth control. The fact that it's kind of a one and done procedure also makes it much more accessible. You don't have to keep buying the same prescription every month if you don't have insurance. It can be very helpful as well for, there are people who, men say they don't want to wear a condom, or women who are worried about getting their partner to wear a condom, and that's not necessary with this procedure. So that kind of removes that from the equation as well.
Is there any way that the World Health Organization could champion this, could actually bring it to market?
I don't really know to what degree they're involved in bringing things to market. I think they're probably not. I think they could certainly, have advisories for this, help people become more informed about it. I think ultimately it's probably the pharmaceutical companies who are going to have to bring it to market.
The burden for birth control has largely fallen on women, and you've talked about that. What impact could male birth control have on relationships?
I mean, I think it certainly would provide a lot more options for couples, and a lot of the times, women put up with a lot of side effects to be on birth control and to take control of their reproductive health, and sometimes, the options that we have available are not really compatible. Some people find that they struggle with depression or mood swings when they're on the pill to the degree that they really can't use it. Some people have complications with IUDs to the point where they really can't use it. And anything that gives couples more options is really going to sort of relieve that burden.
We're talking right now with Julie Beck. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, covering health. We're looking at male contraceptives as researchers in India prepare to launch the first new form of male birth control in more than a century.
And we want to know what you think about birth control for men. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Would you like to see more men take charge of contraception? What do you think the pluses or minuses of birth control for men could be? Are you a man who would consider using a contraceptive like this one? Why or why not? Our number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing the conversation with Julie Beck, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, covering health. And we're talking about a new medical advancement on the horizon. It's an injectable male contraceptive.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, should drug companies consider selling male birth control? Why or why not? Do you see a double standard when it comes to who takes responsibility for contraception? Tell us if you would consider using male birth control or asking your partner to. And if you want to share your personal experience, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our phones now with Regina in Denmark, Wisconsin. Hi, Regina.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I want to express how excited I am for the possibility of this from the aspect of a mother of a teenage son. As he's getting ready to become sexually active, one of the things I think about is if his partner were to become pregnant, he has an obligation, a financial obligation, for the entire life of that child. So I think by giving him the ability to take some control over the situation as well is very positive.
Julie, how could male birth control be revolutionary?
Yeah, I think that there are just so many fewer options for men. I mean, it's really two ends of the spectrum and nothing in between right now. You can use a condom or you can get a vasectomy, and maybe it would be nice to have something in the middle of those two extremes, as there is for women.
Well, Regina, thank you so much for your call. And you can weigh in on this discussion, 800-642-1234. Julie, you've written that birth control for women has been revolutionary. How has it affected women's options for family planning and professional and educational goals?
Yeah, I mean, I think the family planning, you know, revolution is kind of self-explanatory there. But, you know, so many of the advances that women have made over the past decades are directly attributable to the availability of birth control. You know, the availability of birth control is directly responsible for the declining teen birth rate in the United States, which has actually been going down for decades now. I think Planned Parenthood had a study that said like 30% of the increase of women in skilled careers could be directly attributed to birth control. And I think, you know, that's why women are willing to put up with so many side effects. You know, people sort of characterize male birth control as inconvenient or they wouldn't want to take it. And, you know, women are more likely to tolerate it, and they are, because having it is just directly responsible for so many opportunities that they have.
Let's take another call now. Momo in Wisconsin. Hi there.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, I agree with what the last caller was saying, you know, sort of leveling the playing field, as they said, you know, bridging that gap. But I understand that, you know, some people don't want to use a condom or whatever, but you're sort of, I guess it's a way for men to take responsibility for it, you know. Instead of just using a condom, they can know for sure, because, you know, maybe it's not 100%, but it's, you know, condoms break, stuff happens.
Julie?
Hi. So unfortunately, I think due to a glitch perhaps on our end or yours, I'm not able to hear the callers. So could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, basically he said, you know what, this is a way for men to take responsibility, and that condoms break, things happen.
Yeah, you know, things do happen. And, you know, obviously condoms are not the, like, number one recommended birth control. You know, IUDs and implants and LARCs, long-acting reversible contraception, is the sort of gold standard of birth control now. And, you know, what the new procedure that's coming out of India is kind of a long-acting reversible contraception for men. And I think it would be great, you know, if men had the option, if they wanted to take control of their, you know, reproductive health in the same way that women do, it would be amazing to have that.
And really quickly here, let's go to Robert in Appleton. Hi, Robert. Oh, are you there? I hear your radio on.
Hey, oh, yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
I completely agree with the whole male contraception thing. My biggest fear would be guys not wearing condoms, passing on STDs from partner to partner, and I could just see it becoming a whole mess.
Julie?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I think we're talking mostly here about birth control, the birth part, right? You know, I think it's still important to use condoms with new partners. It's still important to get tested for STDs. And I think this is more sort of a long-term option for people in committed relationships. And, you know, even if you are using some method of birth control, of course, you know, when you're with someone new, you should use a condom, so.
And Julie, as we begin to wrap up here, what do you think has to happen next in order for male birth control to become widely accessible?
You know, I really think it has to be a culture change, because I feel like the technology is here and the demand seems to be here. And it's kind of baffling to me that it's still characterized as inconvenient. I mean, this is, you know, a one-time procedure that you can easily be reversed. And so I think when people say that it's inconvenient, what they're really saying is it's inconvenient for men, which, yes, doing something is more inconvenient than doing nothing. But that procedure is much, much more convenient than a woman taking a pill every day, you know, maybe even more convenient than an IUD, depending on how the side effects work out for people. And so I think there has to be a sort of culture change from the top.
Thanks so much for joining us. Julie Beck is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she covers health and psychology. She joined us to talk about male contraception as researchers in India prepare to launch the first new male contraceptive.
Now, our next installment in our year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin.
Wetlands and business have long been at odds with one another. As in industry, housing and agriculture expand, there is pressure to fill swamps, marshes, and bogs. But there are a growing number of companies whose business is restoring wetlands in Wisconsin to make up for what's lost.
Rich Kramer reports on the world of wetland mitigation banking and the challenge of recreating ecosystems that took millennia to develop.
Outside the city of Cornell in Chippewa County, Nick Haas steers a vehicle he calls the Swamp Buggy into a 100-acre wetland known as Foggy Acres.
Do you smell the rotten egg smell?
Yeah.
So the site's only like 5 years old, but you're starting to get some of those, the soil anaerobic conditions returning to the site. So that's the production of sulfide in the soil, and that's the sulfide gas you smell, and that's a good thing.
Many of the native plants are just starting to green up, but the site is bustling with birds, ducks, and a pair of sandhill cranes. It may not look it, but Foggy Acres is actually a business known as a wetland mitigation bank. Here's how it works. A company that wants to fill in a wetland buys credits from a nearby bank, creating what regulators call a net neutral impact. Haas is the project manager for Wisconsin Wetlands LLC, which owns Foggy Acres. He says they've sold credits to utilities, local governments, and frac sand mines for around $50,000 apiece.
In most of the areas, that's around $60,000, so our top would be that, but realistically, we charge between $40 and $60,000.
There are 13 private mitigation banks like Foggy Acres in Wisconsin, but it's not enough. In fast-developing regions like the Fox Valley, credits quickly sold out. So in 2012, the legislature passed a law creating what's called an in-lieu fee program. DNR Waterway and Wetlands Section Chief Marty Griffin says it allows developers to buy credits before wetland restoration begins.
Instead of having pre-established banks on the landscape or wetland restoration areas, basically you pay into a conservation fund, which then the department puts out requests for proposals to fund projects in the watershed to offset those losses.
The DNR has sold more than $15 million in credits, but none of its five restoration projects have gotten final federal approval to begin. The DNR hopes to begin construction this fall. The 2012 law also limited how far companies like Georgia-based Meteor Timber had to look for alternative sites before they destroy wetland. Meteor wants to fill 16 acres of forested wetlands in Jackson County to build a frac sand plant. CEO Chris Mathis says the loss is unavoidable.
Simply put, other sites are either too far away, that would result in the project being uneconomic, and fiduciarily we could not support construction of the project.
To sweeten the deal, Meteor promises to buy mitigation credits and preserve or restore 400 acres of wetlands on other property it owns. But the question remains, does creating or restoring wetlands in one area offset the loss in another? Mitigation bankers and consultants say many projects have been successful, although some in Wisconsin have struggled with invasive plants. And a global study published last year found that restored areas generally only had half of the abundance and one-third of the diversity of plants and animals compared with natural wetlands. Joy Zedler is UW-Madison's Aldo Leopold Chair of Restoration Ecology. She says wetlands are more functional for human well-being than all other ecosystems on Earth.
So wetlands are super important, and they should be held on a very high pinnacle before we decide to go and damage them.
Wetland mitigation is a learning process for all involved, but it's also a political issue. And after President Donald Trump signed an executive order in February repealing a clean water rule enacted during the Obama administration, many are wondering whether requirements to restore wetlands will be around much longer. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.